This episode of Outlines contains descriptions of a crime which some people may find distressing. So as always, listener discretion is advised. Today, we begin on a road, specifically the A327. The part we're looking at runs between the villages of Arborfield and Shinfield in Berkshire. And specifically, we're looking at a lay-by, or an illegal tipping site, or a small, scrubby turning just near the Two Bridges Thames Water Pumping Station, directly before a sign welcomes you to Arborfield, and a bridge takes you across the banks of the River Loddon. It was early in the morning on Saturday the 16th of November 1996, when drivers on the road noticed a fire at the flytip. One of these witnesses, Paul Curtis from Calcot, told the Reading Evening Post, "I was driving past at about 5:30 a.m. when I saw a small, uncontrolled fire in the hedges. It stood out so well because it was pitch black at that time in the morning. I called the fire brigade on my mobile, and when I drove back 20 minutes later after dropping a friend off in Camberley, I saw the fire engine was already there." Paul wasn't the only one to call the emergency services. Another passerby stopped at a nearby Esso petrol station to use their phone box, and there were plenty of other witnesses too. As Paul said, the fire stood out on that pitch black November morning. In photographs taken at the time, the place is no more than a rubble-strewn lay-by, flanked by a low hedge and a rickety chain-link fence, half of which appears to have fallen down. As the fire brigade worked to extinguish the blaze, they realised that it wasn't just rubbish and hedges that were alight there. Laying face down amongst burning logs and tyres, which had apparently been intentionally stacked to create what was described by one article as a makeshift pyre, was the body of a woman. She was partially clothed, apparently in only her suspender belt and a petticoat, and she hadn't been sexually assaulted, but there was bruising to her face, and eventually, though the badly burnt state of her body made it difficult to quickly establish her cause of death, it was revealed at the post-mortem that she had been strangled. While the authorities sealed off the scene, their blue and white police tape strung between metal posts, news of the discovery was beginning to filter through the local community. On St Barnabas Road in Shinfield, 41-year-old Brian Holland was at home when he began to hear the rumours. It had been 2 days since his wife had disappeared. Since then, he had been in a state of what he described as sheer panic. Later, after police confirmed that the body was indeed that of his wife, his panic would give way to disbelief. Because she had only left home to make the 5-minute walk to the local KFC, and yet she had never returned. And now, almost 28 years later, the question of who killed 47-year-old Vera Holland still remains a mystery. I'm Jess Carter, and this is the Outlines podcast. Vera was born Vera Gladys Nellie Laura Vince in Battersea, London, in April 1949, to her parents Leslie and Gladys. There's very little to be found on her early life. Only one short paragraph in the papers about the marriage of her brother, in which the bride, Rita, wore a long dress of nylon and lace and was attended to by Vera. An ancestry search tells me that in October of 1967, she was married for the first time to Edward Bennett in Wandsworth. The couple had 2 children together, Dawn, born in 1965, and Andrew in 1969. By 1978, Vera and Edward had divorced, and in that year she married again, this time to Richard Stevens in Lambeth. In 1981, Vera gave birth to their daughter. I can't find anything else until 1991, when again, records tell me that she was married once more, this time to Brian Holland, who was 6 years her junior. At the time of her death, in November 1996, papers reported that the couple had both worked doing a milk round in the nearby town of Wokingham. Detective Superintendent Michael Short, the man in charge of the murder investigation, described Vera and Brian as an extremely hard-working and normal couple. Perhaps with an eye on their readers' sentimentality, the Reading Evening Post called them inseparable. They lived on St Barnabas Road with Vera's youngest daughter, 15-year-old Claire. The house where they lived is described as being in Shinfield, or Shinfield Rise, and, looking at maps of the area, it seems to be situated somewhere at the very bottom of the town of Reading, just above the small area which makes up the village of Shinfield, in a no-man's land between one and the other. There weren't many photographs of Vera circulated at the time of her murder. In most, she can only really be described as a very normal-looking woman. She had pale skin and light hair and was always smiling for the photographs. There's probably nothing that would really set her apart. Except there's one photo, and it's by far the most disturbing of all of them. It's a police-compiled composite image. There's Vera's head superimposed onto the body of a policewoman, dressed in the clothing that she was wearing on the evening she disappeared. This is a light pink, thigh-length coat, old-fashioned looking, with what appears to be a black knee-length skirt and black shoes. The policewoman stands with her hands in her pockets, and Vera's head, the neck a touch too big for the body beneath it, is turned slightly to one side, her eyes vacant and downcast, staring just off to the right of the photo. She has a slight flick to her choppy ear-length hair, a spiky fluff of short fringe, and a strong jaw with ruddy cheeks. In the picture, her hair appears dark brown, though papers at the time described it as browny blonde. There's something uncanny about the image. The model stands in an all-white space, dislocated from her environment. Vera's head is a touch too large, her expression a touch too sad. It's hard to get a handle on who she was from just a handful of photographs. Unusually for a case like this, there were few interviews with her family and none that I could find with friends or neighbours. What happened to Vera feels, at first reading, to be the most mysterious and sensational type of killing, and yet there is an absence of all but the very basic facts. What we do know is that at some time around 6 p.m. on Thursday, November the 14th, 1996, Vera left her house on St Barnabas Road, intending to walk the 5 minutes between there and the KFC, which stood, and still does stand, on Shinfield Road. She was reportedly dressed in a pink coat, black jumper, and black shoes. The last confirmed sighting of Mrs. Holland appears to be when she left her house. CCTV at the KFC confirmed that she never made it there. Staff could not recall seeing anything suspicious, and, according to police spokesman Noel Miller, speaking at the time, there had been no witnesses who saw her walking to the takeaway. By 10:45 that evening, Brian Holland called the police, and what followed over the next day and a half was what he described as sheer panic. What happened to her between 6 p.m. on the Thursday and 5:30 a.m. on Saturday morning still remains a mystery. What we do know, though, is that, according to Detective Superintendent Michael Short, Police believed that she had not been held prisoner. It was established that she had probably been killed on Thursday the 14th, and her body stored until at least Friday evening, before being taken that short distance to the flytip on the A327 to be set alight. At a press conference, Superintendent Short confirmed that during the investigation into the blaze, police found evidence to suggest that the killer went back to the scene and rekindled it, shortly before it was spotted by passing motorists. Immediately following the discovery of Vera's body, police, including 11 detectives from Reading, began by cordoning off the Hollands' home, while for 3 days forensic teams searched for clues. Blood and fingerprint tests were taken from Brian, and in all, over 100 samples were collected from the couple's house. On Thursday the 21st of November, a reconstruction of Vera's last known movements took place, with police officer Linda York walking the 5-minute route from St Barnabas Road to KFC a number of times, in the hopes that it might jog someone's memory. As well as the focus around the home, officers compiled a questionnaire to be answered by motorists along the stretch of road where her body was left. A spokesman said, "People follow trends. We are hopeful that there are people who take that same route to and from work and might have seen Mrs. Holland. We are hopeful it might yield more clues." While traffic stops are commonplace during a murder investigation like this one, something that strikes me as being somewhat more unusual was the police's desire to make sure that the public knew, via the papers, that they would be trying their hardest to avoid what was termed traffic chaos while the questionnaires were carried out. Is it just me, or is a little commuter hold-up a fair price to pay when you're conducting a murder investigation? On 2 consecutive Thursdays, motorists near to Vera's home and along the A327 near the fly-tipping site were questioned. There were, according to the papers, thousands of cars every day which passed by the spot where she was found. Between the questionnaires and phone calls from the public, police quickly began to compile a list of vehicles which they wished to trace. The most prominent of these were what was described as a white transit-type vehicle, along with a white or beige Ford Fiesta. The Fiesta appears to have been seen by more than one witness, hence the colour confusion. It was apparently sighted a little while before 5 a.m. on Saturday, November the 16th, near the entrance to Hall Farm, not far from where Vera's body was discovered. Conflictingly, it was also reported to have been seen on the Friday night. This report had the van driving off at high speed onto the farm estate. It's unclear if this was 2 separate times that potentially the same vehicle had been spotted in the area, or if reports have just confused the timings. Either way, it appears to have been some interest to the police. Superintendent Short said, "There is no evidence to suggest that either vehicle was involved in Mrs. Holland's death, but we are anxious to speak to both drivers in case they witnessed anything important." It was reported that the transit van was seen on a number of occasions in the location and stayed for some time. At that point, the area around the River Loddon was popular for walking and fishing, and while the transit van might have been involved in Vera's murder, it was more likely to have been fishermen, or even fly-tippers, returning to their dumping ground. Fly-tipping is illegal, but police were keen to point out that if someone with information were to come forward, they didn't need to worry about prosecution if they had been involved in the practice at the time. While the investigation moved into its second week, on Monday the 25th of November, Brian Holland gave an interview to the Reading Evening Press. Brian, who was staying close by with relatives, spoke of how he had been trying to cope with his wife's murder. He said, "It hasn't sunk in at all yet. When people talk about it, it is like talking about someone else. I've told my family I don't want to talk about it yet. I'm not ready. I'm still half expecting Vera to walk through the front door. The children have taken it really hard. Vera's daughter Claire has gone up to Lincolnshire to stay with relatives, just to get away for a while. Everyone who knew Vera is still in a state of shock. I just can't understand what could have happened. The only people who come down here are people who live here. There is no other access. And that's an interesting fact. The area in which the Hollands lived was one of those red brick housing estates. The kind that if you don't know where you should be, you're likely to find yourself going around in circles or down multiple cul-de-sacs before you finally find your way out again. Brian obviously felt that whatever had happened, it must have been the fault of someone close by. While I don't know for certain, I'd imagine that it was this line of thought which meant that on Tuesday the 17th of December 1996, it was announced that two people from the Reading area had been arrested. A spokesman for the Thames Valley Police said, "A 50-year-old man and a 42-year-old woman have been arrested in connection with the murder of Vera Holland. They are currently being questioned by police. They were arrested early this morning at about 6:30 a.m. The spokesman refused to give any other detail, would not say if the pair were a couple or if they lived close to the Hollands' home. Following some speculation, the papers reported that the people involved were Richard Stevens, Vera's ex-husband, and his wife, Kay. Interestingly, the couple lived only a few doors down from Brian and Vera on St Barnabas Road. Despite wide publication of their names, police continued to refuse to confirm their identities, and they were released after 12 hours with no charge. Following the Stevens arrest in January, although it doesn't appear to have made the papers at the time, Brian Holland himself was also arrested. He was questioned for a day before being released on bail. By March, he was threatening legal action against the police for their handling of the case. The Thames Valley Police in turn said, "We sympathise with the family of Vera Holland following her murder and understand the distress an inquiry of this nature can bring. We are sensitive to this and try to minimise any distress caused." With the exception of these, as far as I'm aware, there have been no other arrests in Vera's case. In February of 1997, in a move which police were keen to state did not mean that they were struggling to find Vera's killer, a sign was erected by the roadside where her body was found. It read, "Thames Valley Police, Murder of Vera Holland. Did you pass this location between Thursday the 14th of November 96 and Saturday the 16th of November 96? If so, please contact the incident room." It's an unusual move to use a sign to appeal for information in a case like this, but off the back of it, what seemed to be 11 promising new leads were called in, a number which spokesman Noel Miller was keen to point out was a good return, considering that it had been months since the discovery of Vera's body. Assumedly following on from these tip-offs, in addition to the vehicles identified earlier, police also appealed for the drivers of a light-coloured Ford Escort-type van and a black Ford Granada to come forwards. This case has something of an odd feel to it. There is very little available information, despite the horrific nature of the murder, and not only that, but Thames Valley Police seem to have been hesitant to share much of what they knew with the public. Often detectives involved refused to discuss the case, and when, in July of 1997, it was reported that the investigation was being scaled back, the reply was cagey, with a spokesman saying, "The investigation of the murder is still continuing. Staffing levels fluctuate from time to time, and I will not go into specifics." Perhaps the only piece of really pertinent information came at the end of February 97. On the 24th of the month, Detective Superintendent Short spoke about the police's only real clue. a piece of fawn or beige-coloured carpet, which had been found alongside Vera. It was 9 foot 4 inches by 8 foot 2 inches and contained traces of blood, indicating that it had been used to carry Vera's body to the flytip where she was found. Detective Superintendent Short told the Reading Evening Post, "I think this is ever so important. If we find that one person with knowledge of this carpet, we'll go a long way to finding out who killed Vera." The theory was that she had been killed and her body stored for more than a day before being rolled up in the carpet and disposed of the night before the discovery was made. The carpet, which was described as being bedroom quality with a foam back, had 2 equal-sized furniture indentations on one edge and 2 radiator pipe holes on the opposite side. There were soil and weeds growing on the carpet itself, which led police to surmise that it had been stored outside before. It strikes me as odd that it would take 3 months for police to release this information, because surely the description of the carpet was more likely to jog someone's memory if it was mentioned much closer to the time of its discovery. Perhaps the police had their reasons to withhold the information. Reading between the lines, it seems as if the early investigation focused on those close to Vera, and when those lines of inquiry dried up, they widened the net. By October of 1997, the inquest finally opened at Windsor's Guild Hall. During proceedings, Detective Superintendent Short finally admitted that the investigation had effectively stalled. There had been 1,669 people interviewed, 777 statements taken, and the 3 arrests, and yet DS Short said, "There is no evidence to pass the case on to the CPS for a decision to be made on a prosecution, unless new evidence comes to light." Speaking to Vera's husband Brian and her 16-year-old daughter Claire, both of whom were present, East Berkshire coroner Robert Wilson recorded a verdict of unlawful killing, saying, "It looks like the person who did this will get away with it." He added that strangulations rarely get to coroner's court. Someone is found and prosecuted. If there is to be no prosecution, the fact should be made public. It is a conundrum, and I have to leave it to the police. Speaking after the inquest, Vera's sister, Ida Vince, told the gathered press that the family had lost, but were satisfied with police efforts. She said, "I've lost my best friend, my best mate, and someone has got away with it. The police have done all they can, but just can't prove anything." On the 20th anniversary of Vera's murder, police announced a review of her case. Peter Bairn, head of the Thames Valley Police's Major Crimes Review Team, reiterated to reporters that police believed that the fire had been started in an attempt to get rid of her body, and said, "The public did assist and came forward with information in 1996. However, I do feel that there are people who have some information who, for whatever reason, have not spoken to the police. It might be that allegiances have changed in the last 20 years, or you know something now that you didn't at the time. Vera's family have waited a long time for justice. With your help, we can find out what happened and bring those responsible to justice." As well as the Thames Valley Police, Vera's daughter Dawn and son Andrew also spoke to the press. In their statement, they said, "20 years ago today, someone murdered our mum. In doing so, they robbed us of the love and care that she brought to our family. Our children, her grandchildren, never got to know her properly, and mum never had the opportunity to see her grandchildren grow. What made mum's death even more difficult for us was the callous way her body was dumped amongst rubbish and then set fire to. It robbed her of any dignity. What adds to our anguish is not knowing who was responsible for this horrific crime, and that they have been able to carry on with their life for the last 20 years. We have had 20 years of not knowing who did this. There must be some people that have information that could help the police. We appeal to you to think of how you would feel if it was your mum that had been killed in such a way, and ask that you contact the police with any information, no matter how small, as it may help. There's something which feels very off about the way this whole case was covered. The sparsity of information seems unusual. What happened to Vera Holland was, on the surface, the most baffling kind of crime. A woman steps out to visit the local KFC, a 5-minute walk away from her house. She never makes it there. Instead, she is discovered 2 days later, partially dressed, having been beaten, strangled, and so badly burnt that she has to be identified through dental records. Her husband is arrested and released. Her ex-husband and his wife are arrested and then released. And through all of it, police remain seemingly unwilling to engage meaningfully with the press or to have any kind of grasp on what might have happened. It's a narrative that just doesn't seem to sit right. But perhaps they did have a grasp on it and just weren't willing to share the information. I'm drawn to the statements made at the inquest by Coroner Robert Wilson and Vera's sister, Ida. Robert Wilson said, "If there is to be no prosecution, the facts should be made public." And Ida, "The police have done all they can, but just can't prove anything." Perhaps the police's reticence was as a result of feeling as if they knew what had happened to Vera, but that, as Ida said, they just couldn't prove anything. And perhaps, after 28 years, they just still can't. If you've enjoyed today's episode and are interested in supporting the Outlines podcast, then please consider signing up on Patreon for just £3 a month. Or you can donate via PayPal at theoutlinespodcast@gmail.com. All the information will be in the description box below. Apologies to those of you who are patrons before, but I think having the one lower price tier means that you will have to re-sign up if you wish to and haven't already. While I'm getting back into the swing of things, episodes might be a little bit sporadic, but hopefully they'll level off eventually. And thank you all for sticking with the show. It's a real pleasure to be back, and I look forward to all of your thoughts on the case. This episode of Outlines was researched, written, performed, and produced by Jess Carter. The music was composed by Elias Hardy.